This is the John Gambling Show on News Talk Radio 710 WOR.
Now, with New York's only local News Talk morning radio program, here are John Gambling and Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
And Mr. Rock, thank you very much for that introduction here on that Friday in January, even it's after 8 o'clock, and Mayor Michael Bloomberg is indeed here. Good morning, sir. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And, you know, we have some good news for New Year's. Just found out last night.
What happened?
Having
to do with the kiss?
No, the Archbishop of the Catholic Church is going to be in New York. The New York Archdiocese is going to be made a cardinal.
Heard that this morning.
And so we'll have two cardinals, Cardinal Egan and soon to be Cardinal Dolan. Right now you call him Your Excellency, and then he'll be Your Eminence.
Your Eminence, yes.
Don't make a mistake.
I do.
He's a good guy, and I think it's great for New York City and great for the church.
I wonder how many other cities have two cardinals. I know Egan is retired, technically retired.
Yeah, but I have absolutely no idea.
Nor do I, but it is a nice elevation, and it's.
I'm sure Stu Loza right now is trying to figure that out.
All right, good to have you aboard here. We all watched you on New Year's Eve. It looked like you were having a good time, not only with Lady Gaga, but with Diana and the rest of the throngs out there.
Great time, good weather, wonderful advertisement for New York City. And everybody enjoyed it.
And nobody got hurt.
It was fun. About 26-year-old, young entertainer. Just if you think about it, she's done a spectacular job. In a business where you can't last more than one record, she's already a couple of years
into it. Top of the heap.
People say she makes the decisions, and, in terms of what and where, when, how. Quite an entertainer, and she couldn't have been nicer.
All right. One thing you did this week, you were up in Albany with a lot of other people for the governor's State of the State.
Yep.
Your reaction, I've got some specifics, but your reaction to the overall?
Well, governor laid out a plan, had a successful first year, has some ambitious plans for the future. He's going to have to work hard to get all that stuff done because nothing's easy, but he's at least got a plan, and he's plowing ahead. And now I think it's up to all of us to give him input, give him help. You don't have to agree with him on everything, but, whether it's the president, the governor, the mayor, anybody. I said this again yesterday. If they are successful, then we are successful. And that doesn't mean you can't vote or run against or whatever. But we should be supporting President Obama while he's president, whether you voted for him or not, whether you plan to vote for him again or not. Same thing for the governor, same thing for the mayor.
All right, you've always been an advocate for conventions facilities better than what we have.
What we have is a disgrace. We've had 50 million tourists this year, but it would be easier, and we could do more if we had a much more state-of-the-art, both in size and technology, convention center. And governor's got a plan, and we should push forward that. If anybody's got any input, better ideas, I'm sure he'd love to hear from you.
You think the location is workable?
Well, you have to put things where there's land. I mean, so, you know.
Would you advocate to keep the Javits Center, do you think?
You'd have to look at the numbers. We're also talking about a smaller convention center at Willets Point. Convention centers are very expensive and very hard to make money with them. In this case, it's tied up with, if I understand the proposal, with casino gambling.
Mm-hmm.
Casino gambling is also something that's hard to do. If you take a look, I saw Mohegan Sun is
just about bankrupt.
A lot of the casino businesses are really about entertainment. Las Vegas is not about gambling. It's about entertainment. People think of it as gambling, but it's the entertainment where they make their money. How that all works out here. The advantage of what the governor proposed is that there's a big piece of land available. And if you improve the mass transit to it, which is at least in theory doable because there are railroad tracks going there, and it's on a, you know, that's a Long Island has an awful lot of people there. It's like Atlantic Yards, where there's probably more mass transit for Atlantic Yards than there is for Madison Square Garden at Penn Station. Tying all that together, nothing's going to happen overnight, and there's going to be Lots of work to do, and the governor's put his team to it, and let's see if we can get something done.
Let's see here. What's the Education Commission that he talked about? The goal certainly is one that is no one will argue with, and that is to improve schools, evaluation, student services.
Well, let's remember, our 75,000 teachers and 2,000 principals and 1,000,001 students have done a pretty spectacular job in New York City. We compare ourselves to the rest of the state because everybody in the state takes the same test, and it's the only easy, the only thing we really can compare apples to apples. And the city is nowhere near where we want it to be, but we've come off a long way, and we're going to keep focusing. And anything that the state can do to help us, we're happy to have, particularly money. Last year we got cut back a lot. This year the governor's promised to increase. Not back to what we had, but from what we got. And, you know, the rest of the state is, if you look at the tests, not done as well. A variety of reasons for that. That doesn't mean they aren't trying or that they haven't made progress. But New York City, because of the diversity of the city and different languages and lots of people with special needs, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why education in New York City is more complex than probably any place else in the country. But and we can criticize everybody and anybody for everything and anything. But nevertheless, if you step back, the product that's been delivered because of teachers and parent coordinators and custodians and principals and school crossing guards and students and parents and everybody else and the taxpayer is pretty impressive in New York, in New York City.
The fact that the city and the UFT evaluatively and John King's suspending the monies of all of this, certainly a disappointment. Is there a negotiation going on? Is there a chance to
salvage? We're always willing to talk to anybody. But, you know, one thing you can't do is you can't wait until the end, play that game of the last card. Sometimes you overplay your hand. And this is something the state clearly, the law that the state passed in order to qualify for money said we would have a rigorous evaluation system with the ability to help teachers that couldn't, weren't getting the results we wanted. And if they couldn't get the help, then move them out, because you've got to have it run for the students. And we are on the ways to doing that. And the city's not going to walk away from what it's trying to do.
There is an interesting article.
And we'd like to have the money, too.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen it in today's New York Times. It is entitled Big yep. Study Links Good Teachers to Lasting Gains, something obviously you have been preaching for a decade or longer.
You know, in real estate, there's three things that matter: location, location, location. In teaching, I would argue there's three things that matter: quality of teacher, quality of teacher, quality of teacher.
And this
you
study,
want the best teachers from the highest, from the best education schools and other schools that are at the top of their class teaching our kids.
This is a very long and research project and a long article. I'm not going to go through it, but what it does say is the authors argue that school districts should use value-added measures in evaluation to remove the lowest performers, despite the disruption and uncertainty involved. The message is fire people sooner rather than later, and you will make a difference in children's lives. Adults' lives, actually.
We have, in this state and in this city, laws about what you can and cannot do with people who are organized and represented by unions. You have to comply with the laws.
Sure.
Unions are there to fight for their members. They're not, the teachers' union is not there to fight for the students. It's there to fight for its members. Now, they may want to help, and I think they do in all fairness, and Michael Mulgrew, I think, certainly does want to have better education, but his job is to get better working conditions and more pay and that sort of thing and protect his members. And nothing wrong with that. If you were a member of that union and he didn't do it, you'd have a real bitch. But our job is to get the best person in front of every single kid that we can possibly find, afford, recruit. And that's what we're going to continue to do.
I argued with Mr. Mulgrew this week, as he was nice enough to talk with me about this, which is not an easy conversation. That eliminating the less active or the less proficient only makes him stronger and the union stronger. It's the weakest ones at the bottom that kind of make the whole thing.
Well, I think most teachers
wobbly.
Want to work with coworkers who are the best. They
right.
take great pride. And so at an individual level, an awful lot of his members would say we should move out those who aren't in the top X percent. Now, you're always going to have a bottom Y percent.
There's always a bottom.
1 minus X. It's always going to be there. I think that's something we're going to have to fight through. The union, the state union as well, for teachers as well as the city one, knew when the plan was being, when the state passed a law that it required them to have a real evaluation system where you can move teachers out that aren't doing the job. And they, I don't know what they thought, but now all of a sudden they've got to do that. And so far we've been totally unable, as has everybody, most other municipalities across the state, to do that. Now, the governor said he's going to come up with a plan where everybody can, where the state can do that, whether or not legal or not. We'll have to see. He'll have lots of, it's not easy to do something like that. But what is clear is that we're going to plow ahead here, make sure we can put the best teachers we can possibly find in front of the class, fight to eliminate those who can't do it. And you know, the union said, we want an independent person. The principal's job is to decide who's good, who's bad. It's their judgment. That's their job. It's like in the private sector. Your boss decides whether you are good or bad. He may not be right, or she may not be right, but that's the job. And you serve at their pleasure. And to say, oh, well, the principal doesn't like the teacher, but the teacher's good, and therefore we have to have an independent person come in. None of us in the private sector work that way, and none of us in the public sector should work that way. And the principal is hired by the public through their elected officials to make those kinds of decisions, and hopefully we get the best principals. The principals' union is very well led. Ernie Logan's a good leader. We've had this training program for new principals going on now for half a dozen years. The quality, not everyone, but the quality of the principals is top notch generally, and they've got to make these decisions, and if they don't make the right decisions, unfortunately, that's just part of the real world. Not every decision is going to be right.
All right, Mr. Mayor, sit tight here. We've gone long in our first segment. Let me remind everybody that we'll be taking questions from you at 800-321-0710. Now is the time to get in line, 800-321-0710. 21 after 8 o'clock. We'll be right back. All right, we continue here with Mayor Michael Bloomberg, 25 after 8 o'clock. Again, your questions. I see a bunch of flashing lights, 800-321-0710. One more on the state of the state, the fingerprinting food stamp question.
When food stamp, number one, we fingerprint anybody that comes to work for New York City. So the providers of things have to, it's no stigma because all of our city employees do it. Most companies do it in this day and age. I don't know who doesn't. It's not painful. It doesn't take any time. It's that sort of thing. And if you don't want your fingerprints out there, maybe there's a reason why you don't want your fingerprints out there. There's an allegation that it slows down the delivery of the service of getting people signed up for food stamps. Number one, we should be working to try to get people jobs where they don't need food stamps, not just get more people on food stamps. So I think we lose sight a little bit of what we're trying to do here. But when it comes to getting people on food stamps, in New York City, it's gone up something like 500,000 people in the last 3 or 4 years.
And I gather at the facilities where they actually do the signing up, the lines are around the block sometimes.
We're trying to move that. We've consolidated some of the things. We actually put in some automated systems where you could do everything except your fingerprinting online. And so you'd walk in and make it quicker. People haven't taken up on that. And we've got to advertise it more, and hopefully that we think will make the process faster. But whether the lines or not, the question is it slowing down? Take a look of the percentage, the people who qualify for food stamps in New York City, a greater percentage of those have signed up for food stamps than the percentage of people who qualify outside of New York City. Now, fingerprinting's only done in New York City. Outside of New York City, it's not done. So if fingerprinting was slowing things down, you'd get exactly the reverse. And I don't see, and I'll talk to the governor about it and try to convince him that this is just not a good idea. You don't want to go back to the old days when everybody was, well, not fair, when some people were double dipping. I think the numbers were when they put food stamps in, they found about 35,000 people who were double and triple and quadruple dipping.
And swapping and selling.
Absolutely. Once you put in the fingerprinting, it went to negligible number. This year, we found 1,900 people who tried. Some were administrative errors, some were fraud, some were, who knows, acts of God, whatever the case may be. But virtually none. People say, oh, well, if there's very little fraud, you don't need fingerprinting. The reason there's very little fraud is because you do fingerprint. And I don't know what the statistics are outside of New York City. It'd be interesting, and I think I will ask the governor to see if he can't get some good numbers and try to figure out how much fraud there is outside. But the fingerprinting certainly doesn't hurt. It's certainly helped in the past. It's one of these things like your police department. We're out there trying to prevent terrorism. Did we prevent it? I don't know. But there hasn't been. So you don't want to find out and not go and try and make sure you have great defenses against fraud.
I have been surprised at the dust up that this has created in the newspaper with people, you know, in people's attitudes, pro and con. But it's like a thorn in the side of society. I think it has to do with the stigma that is attached to fingerprinting that we have seen in the movies. Now, that might sound silly.
Well, the governor wants to collect DNA, and I couldn't agree more.
Correct.
For every crime. He's 100% right, and I'll support him on that one.
Why not get rid of the thumbprint is my point.
And do DNA.
And do iris.
People don't want something signed in. But you could do DNA.
Take your handprint. You know, you just go like that.
Part of New York City's system of bookkeeping to pay our employees is you stick your hand on
a reader
when you walk in the morning. Right. That's exactly right. You know, Bloomberg Terminal, I have a thing. You put your my thumb on it. You can't use it unless it's you.
It's just very surprising.
But, you know, we forget how easy it is to go back to the bad old days when anybody that wanted to get subsidies, whether they deserved it or not, just walked up and said, I'm taking it.
Correct.
You can't go back to those days. And it's like the turnstile of broken windows theory. Small things lead to big things. But we've saved $5 million this year alone because the fingerprints caught 1,900 people who shouldn't have been.
What was the stat you just said about the increase of numbers of people in the city of New York on food stamps?
I got to go back and look at the numbers. So maybe it's 1.8 million out of 8.4 million people. And it's gone up by about 600,000 over the last half a dozen years.
Okay, I'm just curious. Have the qualifications changed? Or is this just need that has increased?
It's a lot more advertising of making sure people know that the service is available. If the government's going to make a service available to people, I think we have an obligation to tell them. You can argue whether or not they should or not. That's not the level I work at. My level is they pass a law that says you are entitled to something, and then a city's going to go out and make sure that people know. Part of it may very well be the economy. You know, we require able-bodied people to work. It's like I've always been a big fan of the earned income tax credit. It is not really a tax credit. It's a cash grant to people who don't make enough to have food and shelter. But they do work. They're doing what we've asked people in America do. You do your share, and then society will help you if you can't make it on your own. And so that's a good plan. You don't get earned income tax credit unless you file a W-2, and I guess that's the standard. You have to be working. And I'm all in favor of reaching into my pocket and your pocket, too, and using tax dollars to help people as long as they're out there trying to help themselves. But if we don't make sure that people who are that the only people that get benefits are those that are legally entitled to them, then at some point the middle class, where all the money comes from, is going to say, enough, we're not going to do it. And that's not good for anybody.
All right, Mayor Michael Bloomberg here on the John Gambling Show. Half hour, 8:31 is our time. Again, remind you, pretty full on the phones, but 800-321-0710. Talk to Mike, and maybe we'll get to your question before we finish up here. Let's get to Joe Bartlett. More news. We continue here on the John Gambling Show. Open up my microphone. Works a whole lot better. Right. Your reaction to the politics, presidential, Iowa, South Carolina coming up?
You know, it's fascinating. The number of people that have gone from nowheres to the top to nowheres again. But you got to look at Iowa and the system. It is a very small group of people, small state, and a small group of people who are politically active. And then we've only focused on those of the Republican Party. And, you know, if you don't shake their hands, they might not want to vote for you. People have done stories about what they talk about, and it's interesting. They talk about personal things when they meet the candidates as opposed to policy things.
It's always, though, you're the politician. You've campaigned. It's always personal, isn't it?
Yeah, but here it's more personal. So it would seem if you read the papers. You know, it's a nice state, nice people. They want to be first. Why everybody focuses on it? It really is a very small sample, and it's Iowa's a state with the economy's doing very well. Not a lot of diversity, immigrants, whatever. It's a pretty homogeneous state, and you know, it's one of the cards, and you got to get through that before you go to the next step. I think somebody said that nobody's ever won Iowa and New Hampshire and not got the nomination. Whether that's going to hold true, I don't know. New Hampshire, the book is that Romney will win it very easily because he used to be the governor of Massachusetts next door, and a lot of New Hampshire people get their television from Boston, the Massachusetts television stations, Massachusetts news, Massachusetts politics. And I saw, it was a story I heard on the radio this morning, that Romney, instead of heading straight to New Hampshire, went to South Carolina to campaign down there, because that's the one after this. But it's just fascinating.
The Boston Globe endorsing John Huntsman rather than the one that you might suspect, which Mitt Romney, former governor of Massachusetts,
Huntsman and Romney casually, both of them. Both are very confident guys, and both can make a case as to why they should be. I've always been surprised that Huntsman is not more of a factor. You know, he didn't make a couple of debates. He didn't even get 5% of the vote. But he's got a chance in other places. And if Michelle Bachmann can go from no place to the top to all the way back, and, you know, there was a Gingrich boomlet and a Perry boomlet. Santorum came from no place. There's no reason why Huntsman can't do the same thing.
In your thinking process, when bouncing around was the idea of Michael Bloomberg to run for president, did you get far enough, at least in your mind and planning stages, to look at the primary process?
No, keep in mind, if you were to run as an, I didn't, number one is the answer, and number two, if you were going to run as an independent, the primary process doesn't matter to you. You wouldn't even think about it.
Right.
It's just not, you know, something that, our primary process is very different, our election process. We have fundamentally two parties that so dominate is very different than an awful lot of other places in the world. England, the campaign, you don't vote for the prime minister, you vote for your local member of parliament. They then pick, and I think if you go back,
they pick the prime minister.
But the Constitution, it was Congress that picked the president? Maybe not, maybe there was just talk about it. I just don't remember my history all that well, but it's a very different kind of system.
I think they did. I think they talked about the Senate actually choosing the president in some place, which again would have been a spinoff of the British parliamentary
system.
Right, which
is, that was where everybody came from.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. So I was talking about this earlier, and this is not directed to the city, but as you know better than probably most people, we have 50% that kind of go from the center to Republican conservative, and 50% that go from the center to the liberal side. How on earth do we ever get to the point where we function and actually solve problems?
Well, we did it before. I think what's happened here is redistricting has been not good for the country, because what you do is you create very safe districts for both parties, so their focus is on their own party only and not on bringing together people from with slightly different views. So the Republicans from the right, Democrats from the left would be the traditional model. And then they get so polarized they can't go to the middle. And democracy is about coming to the middle, making compromises where you don't get everything you want, but you get something, and everybody walks away thinking that they've did pretty well. That's what good democracy is. It's also, you know, the Fourth Estate is more competitive perhaps today than it's ever been before. We go after people's personal lives in ways they did not. If you remember, nobody knew that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was in a wheelchair. I mean, just think about that. It's, you know,
it's incomprehensible today.
Oh, sure. And there are lots of examples like that. But it's harder. And also, there's you can put down a lot of the partisanship to better transportation.
What do you mean by that?
Because it used to be that if you went to Washington as a congressman or a senator, you stayed there for the length of the session, and on weekends you got together and you broke bread and had a few drinks and played a little golf or bridge or whatever you did, went to your book club, but you built relationships across the aisle with your, and even within your own party, with the other senators or congressmen, and that made legislation more thoughtful and people working together. Today,
and the conversation of the legislation would have taken place.
Right. Today, Thursday night, they're on a plane back to wherever, no matter how far away they are, even to Hawaii and Alaska, and they spend their weekends local issues or raising money, and that whole thing of more money gets a lot of the focus when they're home. And then they come back, you know, maybe Monday night for a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, but they don't ever get to meet anybody else, even in their own party. So the focus on money, the focus on the ability to go back, the press constantly fighting about what you bring home for us as opposed for the country, it's, you know, there is a lot of pressure on everybody. So when you're going to build an aircraft carrier, the only reason they'll vote for an aircraft carrier is part of that aircraft carrier is built in their district, even if they are 1,000 miles from water.
Well, I got the smokestack. Right.
Right. So, you know, all of these things lead to more partisanship. Having said that, there's no reason why they can't come together. There's no reason why they can't. I think it was Winston Churchill said that you can always count on America to do the right thing after it's exhausted all the other possibilities. and it's the president's job to pull them together. It's, you know.
But from what you say, and I agree with the model that you've laid out there, that through time that will only get honed to sharper points. All of those digressions. But yeah, I mean,
that's up to you and me and all of the voters to say we're not going to take it anymore. You start focusing on long-term things that matter. If you think about it, we've got in one part of the world, there are four different countries that all have acrimonious relations one with another, and all the four are nuclear powers. China, North Korea, Pakistan, and India. Four nuclear powers in explosive, if you pardon the pun, part of the world where there's lots of skirmishes and whatever. You've got Europe with some enormous economic problems, a financial system that really is under attack. We've got guns on the streets, just all over the place. Healthcare system that's not extending lives the way it should be. New York City's life expectancy has gone up 2.5 to 3 years in the last 10 years. It's also now 2.5 to 3 years greater than the country as a whole. If you look at what's happened to life expectancy in America in the last half a dozen years, it is unchanged. It's not improved one bit. Think about that. With all the medicine and everything, nothing. These are issues that Congress and the White House should
don't
be focusing on, all in Washington. And, you know, we cannot afford it, and it's not giving us good services. The immigrant, we've stopped the people who are going to carry us into the future from and mortgaging our future, committing national suicide, as I describe it. Defense, everybody says I've got a secret plan to stop Iran from getting nuclear bombs. What's the plan? I mean, nobody seems to, the Middle East is coming apart. Some of this stuff may not end as nicely as you would hope it would end. Going to democracy is a very difficult, long road. And an awful lot of people in history have gotten hurt during the push towards democracy. The end result may be worth it, but those that got killed don't think so. And so, you know, you can go right around the world of problems we have here. We don't have enough jobs. We've got an education system we talked about before. The demands of the marketplace for educated people, for the level of education, is growing faster than any improvement we not only are making, but know how to make. I mean, it's really a worrisome thing. Technology, globalization, things you're not going to put back genies in the bottle anymore. You've got to learn how to deal with it, and nobody's focusing on that. There's these petty things of holding up appointments. President's elected by the public, whether you like it or not. He should be able to have his own people. The Senate business of stopping him from picking his own people is just outrageous. That's not what their job is. Advice and consent, it should be, is the person qualified, not do I agree with their positions. The public decided what positions. They voted for the president. Give the president the ability to have, and then don't reelect him or her.
And there go the people that he brought in.
Whatever.
Or she yeah. brought in. Let's see here. 12 down before 9 o'clock. Let me see here. 9/11 system. You finally got a new one in place. You plugged it in.
It's been working for a month now. A lot of technology. This is enormous capacity. We can do something like 40 times the number of calls that we got, some number like that, on 9/11 even. So we think it's, and Verizon, in all fairness, it took a long time, worked very hard. This is not easy stuff. We've built one PSAC, Public Safety something center. And we're building another one up in the Bronx, different electric grid. And
oh, so what, one goes down.
Absolutely. Both will be totally able to handle all the capacity. Mm-hmm. These are the kinds of things you got to do whether you have the money or not. And we hopefully, our focus is on preventing another disaster. But if it happens, I think we're probably better prepared than ever before. Somebody pointed out to me, what would happen if you called up and you said, I think somebody's breaking into my house. I just fell down the stairs and broke my leg, and I dropped a candle, and I've started a fire. Okay? Now you need police, fire, and ambulance. Before, to say three calls is overstating it, but it would have taken you a long time. Here, one call, bang, right away. And it and people say, oh, you know, police and fire don't work together. There's always park bench wisdom stuff. They're doing it. I just was listening to Kelly and Kasana yesterday, both going on and on about how great this system has proven to be. You know, there's always, it's also hard that one of the things, one of the great things about 311, the most difficult thing was not the technology. It was getting the call centers from all these different agencies to work together. They have different titles, different pay scales, different promotion practices and all this sort of thing. And we pulled it together. Same thing is true here. And now this, people aren't going to focus on it, but they are an awful lot better. It's one of the great investments we made and should have made. And
I read a little tiny squib that you've come up with a snow website where I can find out where my snow plow is.
Yeah, I don't know what how it's going to help you.
Right?
Oh no, it's almost ready. It works now for the management. The guy, for example, the way the sanitation department has their equipment deployed is fundamentally this. 8 garbage trucks out there, whether they're picking up garbage or plowing the streets, is the same thing. And there's a supervisor for that. And the supervisor now on his laptop can look and see where every one of those trucks are and where they've been. And it plots it on streets, and it shows you which are the primary, the secondary, tertiary streets, all of that. There's one more tweak that will make it better. We did it for very minimal cost. A cell phone, which costs next to nothing compared to these very expensive automatic vehicle locators. And we've been using them now since last year, and they work. And there's always a handful that are broken, and the truck gets broken down, but fundamentally they work. And there's no reason not to make this available to the general public. The interface has to be a little bit easier, so you don't. Right now, you go in with code numbers.
Yeah, no.
You know, you want it to be in English.
It's got to be an app.
Right, and it's got to be an app close to that, and that's what we're working on. A few weeks, maybe sometime in February, if I had to guess by the end of February, maybe even earlier.
All right, Mr. Mayor, we got some folks on the telephone that have some questions. We will get
you,
to
Mr.
Mayor. Let's go right to the telephones here. We're going to start with line number two, and that happens to be Moses. Hello, Moses.
Good morning, Mr. Gambling. How are you doing?
I am fine. You've got the mayor. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning.
Good
morning, Mayor, but I'm Mike Bloomberg. The police academy is going to be starting on Monday. I would like to know how much people y'all be accepting inside the new police academy.
I can barely hear you. Sorry. I think it's Tuesday that we have a new class of 900 police officers coming in. They're not police officers yet. They're applicants, whatever, starting training. Hopefully they're all going to become great police officers. And we just graduated about 2 weeks ago, 1,550-odd, came from 58 different countries, spoke 64 different languages. It was really quite amazing. And I knew two or three of them, their parents.
Does every member of every class become a police officer if
no,
they graduate?
This is a very tough, rigorous, and there's a certain percentage that just they decide that it's not for them is a nice way to phrase it, or we help them decide. But nothing is automatic in this police department. You have to be, there's a reason why we call them the finest. And we're going to make sure that they stay the finest. And you do that by only accepting those you think will turn out great, and then during training watch and those that you made a mistake and you took them but it turns out they can't cut the mustard, you just decide better to for everybody go the separate ways.
What's the total number of the police force at the moment?
35,000, some number like that.
It's a lot of people, and
we have a lot of people, and that's why this is the safest big city in the country.
All right, Moses, thanks a lot for the telephone call. Jamie is on line five here. I'll push the button. Jamie, you've got the mayor. Go ahead.
Hi. I want to talk to you about what you said about the teachers and impasse with the DOE. There's a fact that is left out in this debate so often. Not so many years before you became mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, a principal or a vice principal had to have at least 10 years of teaching experience to become a principal. But since the Leadership Academy was instituted, this has changed. We now have a huge influx of new principals and vice principals who have little or no teaching experience. That's not always the case, but in many, many, many times, especially with the increase in number of principals with the breakup of the big schools. Now, this calls into question the evaluation process itself. What are you afraid of, Mayor, by having an independent arbitrator judge a dispute when there's a teacher?
We're not afraid of anything, but we were hired to do that. The principal's job is just like John Gambling's boss. He's got to make the decision. Now, it is true, as you say, that there are a lot of new, younger principals that haven't had as much experience in teaching. But number one, the sales manager doesn't have to be the best salesman or salesperson in a sales organization. It's the skills of managing and evaluating people are different than the skills of doing it. Nobody suggests that the coach of the New York Giants can throw the football the way Manning can. On the other hand, he's got to make the decision which quarterback and put him in or not. And you're right that it's less, they have less experience, but it's not clear that they don't have better skills to do exactly that. And we have right now a system where an arbitrator gets in there. You cannot go on. These cases go on forever, for years. It's virtually impossible. It used to be that we had 98% of the teachers get tenure. Now it's down to roughly 50%. My numbers may be slightly wrong, but it's something like that. Because all of a sudden, we're taking a more careful look, and we're trying to help those teachers that don't get tenure the first time. Hopefully, they will improve and get tenure, but you can't just make it. There's no area that I know of that's successful where you automatically select and make decisions as to who's doing a good job and bad job. And it is subjective. There is just no question. It's always subjective. Your boss decides whether or not you sink or swim. And if they're good bosses, they don't let personal issues or prejudices get in the way. They look at the facts and make decisions. But when you have the ability, when there's a set of facts and you could go left or right depending on your judgment, but using the same facts, and you could be as equal chance of being right, that's fine. I mean, an arbitrator wouldn't do any differently, incidentally. Just bringing in a third party doesn't make any sense, and it takes away the reason. If you did that, there's no reason to have principals. Principals' jobs are to pick the staff, lead the staff, make them work together, judge them, and fight for them.
It's crazy not to let management do it. They got a tweet there? We got a few seconds left here.
Yeah, I mean, there's a tweet here about Cornell Technion Investment. What industries are you targeting to come to New York? We all think of technology as social media, and it is partly social media. But keep in mind, it's biotech. It's a whole bunch of different things. Cornell brings an enormous amount of skills there, and in terms of the traditional technology, Technion brings that to there. This is a great addition to New York City, and over the years, for decades, will pay big dividends, and we're lucky that it turned out this way.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's one of the great looking forward moves that the city has been able to make. We have to look forward, and next week you get the weekend off. You get Friday off anyway.
Well, I'm disappointed you told me that, but
yes. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
I'm looking forward to
a couple of weeks.
Goodbye.
All right, have a good time.